As much as you are unaware, it's less karma. But it doesn't mean no karma at all, because there are other conditions for planning the karma. But mainly, to be there and to be conscious, and especially to be aware that it's not right, those are very bad conditions under which to do. If you're going to do a bad deed, it's better if you don't know about it, and you don't know what it means. Okay. But anyway, I'm talking about the regret of a Buddhist who knows how karma is planted, knows exactly why this thing is wrong, knows what the result will be for him or her, clearly, and then because of a klesha attack, okay, because of an attack of one of the bad thoughts, just can't stop themselves. And then the moment after you do it, you feel namasinjimito. You get this regret, intelligent regret. So there's no place in Buddhism for a guilt complex or a low self-esteem or all that stuff. It's just this cold, calculated understanding that this is going to give me suffering in the future. And that it will. And I understand how I did it. I understand how the karma was planted. I understand how the karma will ripen on a blank screen. And I understand that it must come to me. And that kind of regret, you know, understanding regret, saying, I screwed up. This is really bad. I shouldn't have done this. Just that very clear understanding of what you've just set into motion. You've just thrown a cosmic boomerang that way. And to know that it must hit this side of your head in some point in the future, that's intelligent regret. It doesn't mean guilt. It doesn't mean, you know, anything like that. It just means clearly understanding that this thing is going to come back to haunt you. Okay. That's intelligent regret. That destroys the power of the bad deed. Okay? Just to feel sorry, you know, that destroys the energy of the bad deed. That's a very big blow to the energy of that karma. To understand and feel bad about what you did. Okay? It does. Yeah. The opposite of that, you know, which is some kind of arrogance, you know, that's not bad. You know, that's okay. I don't feel sorry. Especially with the bodhisattva vows, makes it extremely bad karma. Okay. Say Nyepale, Larn Dope, Stop. Nyepale, Larn Dope, Stop. Nyepa means bad deed. Le Larn Dopa means to restrain yourself in the future. Okay? To restrain yourself. When non-Buddhists hear about these four powers, they often come up to me and say, you guys have really got it easy. It's like a morning after pill. You know, you can do whatever bad deed you want, and then you just do the four forces after that. And no problem. Most of the karma has gone away. You can do whatever you want. You can do a karma that will take you to hell, knowingly, and then 10 minutes later, do the four forces. It's a real nice life you guys got. Not true because of number three. Number three means part of the purification is to keep yourself from doing again. Okay? And this is the nuts and bolts of purification. This is the guts of purification. This is the main energy behind purification. It's the intention not to do it again. The decision or the resolution not to do it again. Okay. If you don't have that, and if you treat the four forces like a morning after pill, they never will work. Okay. Because number three says you have to truly intend not to do it again. Okay. Now, if it's something like getting mad at your boss, and you sit down at your meditation cushion at 8:30 and you got to go to work at 9, right? And you say, I resolve never to get mad at my boss again. What new bad deed will you then collect? Lying. Okay. If you say I'm never going to get mad at my boss again, and you know by 9:30 something's going to happen, and you get mad at him, then on top of the bad deed, you collect the bad deed of lying. So the oral instruction of the great lamas, of the Lamrim tradition is, set a time limit. Okay? Set a time limit. Set a realistic time limit during which you will not do this thing again. Okay? If you cannot give it up completely, which is unlikely, then set a reasonable time limit. And I always tell people, and it's not a joke, that I have broken the decision again before I finished the four forces. You know, sitting in meditation, figuring out that I'm not going to have a bad thought about my boss again, or my fellow Dharma student again. I have broken this one before I got up from the meditation pillow. So make it realistic, you know. If it's a thought which is bothering you a lot, you might want to say 5 minutes, you know. But normally 24 hours or something like that, you know, like I won't get mad for the next 24 hours at my boss. I will, and the point is that the decision not to do it for that time period makes it very easy to keep your awareness at a high level. You know, you can stand concentrating on not getting mad at a certain person for 24 hours. We can do that. That's the point, by the way, of a one-day vow. Okay, that's the point of a one-day vow. Okay, I can't keep these things my whole life, but if I really concentrate for 24 hours, I could probably do it. As long as I could break it the second day, the next day, you know. I can resist for 24 hours, you know, if I really work on it, and if I don't think about anything else particularly. So choose a realistic time limit, you know. It's all up to you. It's very dependent on your own, you know, how strong is it for you, how bad is it for you. I can imagine being involved in an abortion, for example. In that kind of thing, you could say, I won't do it again in my life. I set a time limit of the rest of my life. You know, I mean, those big ones that take a lot of work and they're very clear, you know, very easy to define, you could say, okay, rest of my life I won't do it. And I know about those things. So, but on other ones, like mental ones, you better keep it short. Okay, you better make it short. It's more realistic. All right, but I repeat, this is the essence of purification. If this part goes well, the purification works. If this part is not strong, and you really don't intend to stop, if it's really not your wish to stop, the purification will not work. And I'm also talking about Vajrasattva, high tantric, you know, all this stuff. The guts of Vajrasattva meditation, purification, is exactly the same thing. The four forces are the essence of Vajrasattva meditation practice. So if you don't have the four, if you think that visualizing some white guy in your head is going to be more powerful than these, or that you don't need these if you have that picture of a person on your head, it's not that way. These must be the essence of that practice as you do it. It's obviously very, very powerful if on top of that you add that. But the whole point of that practice is this. Okay. Okay, what's number four? And this is the last thing for this class. Okay. Say Nyembo, Kuntu, Chepe, To. Nyembo, Kuntu, Chepe, To. Nyembo means antidote, counter agent. Okay. Antidote or counteragent. Okay, nyembo. Kundu chupa means to apply, in this case. Okay, some kind of activity that you do to make up for what you did. Okay, you can think of it as a makeup activity. Okay, a makeup activity. Some kind of activity to make up for what you did. I'll give you an example of a of one. And then I'll give you an example of the one. Okay. I have a fellow student in New Jersey who's Mongolian. When he came to this country in the 60s, he was immediately grabbed by... they gave him a green card and then they drafted him like a week later. Thanks a lot. And he went to Vietnam. And they gave him a machine gun. At first they pulled out all his teeth, and they said, you don't want to get a toothache in the jungle, so we'll pull out your teeth for you. So they pulled out his teeth and didn't give him dentures because they said, you'll choke on it if you get shot. Took him out to the jungle, gave him a machine gun, said, here you go. After a couple of weeks, they're in a they're in a convoy. The convoy gets attacked by Viet Cong, and he's standing on the truck shooting this machine gun into the bushes. You know, he doesn't know if he hit anybody. So he comes to my lama, you know, who's his root lama, and says, "What should I do? You know, what should I do to make up for it?" So he teaches him the four powers, and then he says, "Okay, the make-up activity for you. Mongolians love to eat sheep. Okay, sheep are like chocolate for Mongolians." and in my neighborhood, they will even keep them in their backyards to cut the grass, and then they'll kill them and eat them. And my lama says, "I know that your father is keeping two sheep for that purpose in his backyard. So he says, I want you to buy them from your father, and I want you to take care of them until they die. You know, feed them and care for them until they die. Move them over to your backyard." So he does. And you know how long sheep live? Now, he thought like a couple of years, right? 16, 17 years. He took care of these two sheep, you know. And that was his makeup activity. So it's often useful to pick a makeup activity which somehow relates to what you did. If you were engaged in killing, and I could say abortion or something like that, or some kind of killing in a war or something, then a very good makeup activity would involve some kind of protection of other beings' lives. Okay? And like that, you can imagine the rest. The ultimate, and that's the last point today, the ultimate, and by the way, it's very good to read scriptures, to circumambulate a stupa, say one round of mantras, particular mantra or something like that. Those are all very useful. Those all qualify. But the ultimate one, by far, is the study of emptiness. Okay. The ultimate makeup activity for everything is the study of emptiness. So I'd say you have this notebook, you know, you got this notebook. Through the kindness of one of our, can I say, do you mind if I say that? Where is she? What kind of mommy? Anyway, Mommy Kendall has graciously offered all the cost of the notebooks, okay? So, I mean, I agreed to pay for it, and then I was like, gee, I wonder how I'm going to do that. And she offered all the expense of the notebook. So now you have this notebook. And anytime you commit a bad deed, as part of your purification, really encourage you to just pick one page and read it. It doesn't even really matter. Open it up at some point in the Diamond Kala Sutra and read it and try to digest it. Okay, that is the ultimate makeup force. Okay, that is the ultimate one. Now you tell me why. Why would understanding emptiness have such relevance to being able to stop your bad deeds? Interesting. Yeah, you won't react, okay? That's the punchline. Okay, if you understand the emptiness of that irritating object, whether it's the king cutting your fingers off or your boss blaming you for his last faux pas, or maybe you even did something, but that doesn't happen very often. That's the ultimate refuge, that's the ultimate protection, that is the ultimate way to purify bad deeds. You won't want to do it anymore if you understand his emptiness. Okay? As your understanding of emptiness gets more and more correct and stable. And by the way, at the beginning it's like, forget it, it doesn't do much. You know? At the beginning of this process of studying about emptiness, it's not much use, frankly. You know? It doesn't really help that much. You have to keep working on it. You have to keep reviewing it. You have to keep studying it. And then at some point it becomes an atom bomb that stops all the mental afflictions. It's the only thing that can stop the mental afflictions. And all bad activities are caused by mental afflictions. So naturally it's the most effective way, it's the most effective makeup you can do. And that's why the Diamond Sutra is talking about it here. Okay, that's why the Diamond Sutra is saying, if you study this sutra, what? expect some disaster. Okay. I mean, in Dharamsala, when John and me and other people were first there, I don't know, you remember? I mean, so many disasters. People dying, people going up in flames, people falling off cliffs, people getting hepatitis for 6 months, you know. I mean, those were the good old days. you know, I mean, people were really trying to practice hard. And just major obstacles would come because their karma was ripening, you know. The study of emptiness accelerates the ripening of karma. So I'm not saying, we prefer to think the headache thing would happen, right? And it will. I mean, don't get scared and don't get, you know, panicky and don't throw the book away. do a nice, gentle confession, you know, purification ceremony with those poor. And as the obstacles come, which come with every human endeavor, rejoice. You know, okay, my back aches from this meditation. Interpret it and take it as a ripening of those karmas and rejoice about it. Try to not be thrown off balance by it. You know, accept it as part of the practice and work your way through it. Okay? Will it hurt? Yes. Do you have to react to it? No. Okay, it's the whole thing of being spread-eagled on the ground and having someone, you know. So don't worry that you're going to have major. It doesn't have to be major. The sutra says, and it's in your reading, it can ripen as a headache or a backache or something like that. Poison oak. Where's Amy? Amy's been having a real good class. that's all I have. You have a few questions, and then we'll take a... We'll break this. By the way, tomorrow is a hard day. We got a class, and then the second class starts early, right? 2 o'clock. After that, we have an oral transmission, you know. My lama, I misnamed the lama that gave it to him. I said Dukamba, that wasn't it. It's Kangsar. And we have the oral blessing of this scripture from the time of the Buddha. Lamas have been reading it to their students. And now it'll go to you. So you got the whole thing. You got the instruction. You got the materials. You have these pesky homeworks and quizzes, which you can use for your own students. And God bless. You know, if you have any opportunity to teach even one or two people, do it. You can get all the materials from New York also. If you need more, just call. And we try to make them for free. Okay, so far we've been able to do it pretty much for free. If you can give something, cool. If not, you don't have to worry. We'll send it to you. And if you collect together 3 or 4 students and you want to pass it on, do it. And then if you take the transmission, you actually have the oral blessing that's passed down from mental stream to mental stream throughout the last 2,500 years. So try to catch that. And then... if you want to perpetuate this kind of thing, go have dinner with us. come and have dinner with us. It's really cool. It's a nice way to end the class. And it's a really, it's just a very sweet way to end the class, is to have dinner with all of us together. So try to sign up for that. The money goes to Vajrapani. They need it. This place is not self-existent. If it was, it wouldn't need maintenance. Since it's not, it does need maintenance. And it's priceless. I mean, what you're getting is priceless. So help them out, you know, really help them out. It's important. Okay, any questions? Yeah. Right, yeah. By the way, I wanted to write the name of a scripture. This practice of the four forces was not something made up by Tibetan lamas, okay? It's in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, and it's in the Chu Shipe Do. Say Chu Shipe Do. The Sutra of the Four Practices, okay? Chu Shipe Do. The Sutra of the Four Dharmas, really. What are the four? Those are those four forces. And this is in the Gangyur, it's in the Buddhist canon, the Buddha himself taught it. So it's not just something that Tibetans made up or that the lamas made up or something like that. You can go back to that sutra, you can read it. It's in the Kanya. Okay, so it's good to know that it's spoken by the Buddha himself. Okay. By the way, the homework says describe how Maitreya reaches his enlightenment. That is what I went through at the first, you know, that's those 8 steps. I didn't mention that it was Maitreya, okay? But actually it's the same for everybody, okay? But you might get confused from the homework. It says Maitreya. Okay, any more questions? Yeah. No, totally different. Yeah. Yeah. Next question. Any more questions? Yeah.
In reading 7, yeah, the mention of the 8 bodhisattva Buddha experience.
Yeah.
And it says, all cause objects appear to this person exclusively in the nature of an illusion, as empty of any true existence, not only during periods of meditation. Right. Is deep meditation and direct meditation?
I think it does. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, you know. But I think the point is, from that point on, they don't have illusion in the sense of things looking one way and things looking self-existent and you don't believe they're self-existent. The real meaning of illusion, the main meaning of illusion, is in the steps after the direct perception of emptiness, when you still see things as self-existent, but you don't believe yourself. And that, you know they're false. You know it's an illusion in that sense.
It sounds like it has to be something.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think they're talking Gomlang deep meditation. I think they're talking during the fourth one. But that's not the main meaning of illusion, that reference there. The main one is that after you've seen emptiness directly and after you come out of it, you are intensely aware that what you're now seeing again, the same way you saw it before you went into that meditation, looks to be self-existent. But there's a big difference. You don't believe yourself anymore. And in that sense, it's like an illusion. It's like, you know everything is false. You know in that sense you're crazy. But you can't stop it until you reach the 8th level. You can't stop seeing them that way until you reach the 8th level. Yeah. Well, there's a whole collection of stuff. You know, there's mental parts, physical stuff. Yeah.
How do you relate to people in the world? I mean, if you really feel you're not an I anymore, you're not expressed,
yeah.
But you really are separate from that, but not
as... we talked about it. Say, yugyu-da,
megyu-da.
Yugyu-da,
megyu-da.
There is a me standing up here teaching a class. There is a me which you take data and synthesize and call him, that guy up there. That me exists. And we're going to talk about it more tomorrow. Then there's the me you got, you know, the me that you thought was here, that was out there independent of your projection. That Michael Roach doesn't exist. So there's no problem of going around after you've seen emptiness directly, concentrating on the you got. The self which does exist. There's obviously a self that exists, or I wouldn't be up here talking to you. And there's also a self that doesn't exist because we have suffering. So no problem like that. No big problem like that. It's not like you lose your sense of yourself or something, or there's nobody there anymore, or everything disappears, or you're half there and you're half not there, or something. Not like that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, 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 good. Yeah. And the perception... There's one very important distinction to make. Do the things around you exist? Are those perceptions wrong in that sense? You know, you are perceiving all the events on this platform this afternoon as existing events. Is that wrong? Is there anything wrong with that? No. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a tema, that's a pramana, that's a correct perception, valid perception. Okay, they are happening. They really are happening. Okay, there's something element. There's one element of your perception inherent in that perception, where you interpret these events to be taking place independently of your projection. There's one theme that goes throughout all your perceptions inherently, where you believe these things to be happening independently of your projection. That's the problem. That's the problem. Not the perception of these events. Okay? The perception of these events is a correct perception. These are happening. These are real. You can get enlightened if you pay attention. You know, that's a big deal. They do exist. But there's an undercurrent, or there's a theme, or there's a thread running throughout your perceptions that holds it to be self-existent. And that's the mistake. And you have to eliminate that. But as you eliminate it, it wouldn't be anything like disappearing, or even being less than you feel yourself to be now. The sense of an I is not mistaken. It's the pollution of the sense of an I with the feeling that this is happening external of my projection. And you got to get rid of the one without getting rid of the other. Mm-hmm. So that really prevents the extreme of thinking that somehow things are going to have to disappear for me to be thinking straight. It's not like that. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow also. Yeah. She said, you know, there's two kinds of antidotes. There's two kinds of things to do when you're getting a mental affliction. One is to think about emptiness. And then there are countless other antidotes. Like for anger, you could think that this person is really a bodhisattva who's trying to get you mad so you can work on it. And things like that. And she said, is there a time for each of those? I think I'd have to say yes. You know, in general, there will be moments in your life when you're tired, you've had a bad day, you've had a bad week or a bad month, and you know, emptiness is not going to come in your mind at that moment. Okay, sometimes the best thing is just get out of the room. Okay, go to the bathroom. Okay, tell the boss, look, I know you want to scream at me, but I have to go to the bathroom really bad. Can we do this when I get back? You know, I've done that. You know, and. And if you can't, there's a thing in the Vinaya of, you know, if you can't resist something, avoid it. You know. So yeah, there's definitely a place for those other antidotes. They will not permanently remove your mental friction. Move on to the emptiness antidote as soon as you can. And if you have any strength at all, use that one. If you're just really weakened by being sick or tired or didn't get enough sleep or, you know, didn't eat right or ate too much sugar or had too much coffee or something, if you're weakened spiritually and you can't get to that antidote, then definitely use the other ones. There's a time and a place for all of them. Yeah.
Maybe an ignorant question, but if these events are only taking place in my projection,
yeah.
If I died right now, this event would still be taking place.
But only in the minds of those people here.
Yeah.
And there's no existence of any object independent of those. There's no other existence going on.
But the same event is taking place. You know?
Not exactly the same. You're gone. Yeah. But it's all personal. It is all personal. It is all from your perception. There's actually, you know, 70, 80 events taking place right here. That's the way you have to think of it. We are, because we're all in a human realm. Yeah. You know. Yeah, I know. I'll tell you a story. You know, my mother was dying. I got her to Dharamsala. I was studying there. And I said, at least she can meet the Dalai Lama before she dies. And at that point, she didn't have anything to lose, and she knew it. So she came. The doctor said, forget it. It's over with. You know, you got so much time. You might as well do whatever you want. So she came to India. And we dragged her up to see the Dalai Lama. So we sit down, and he turns to me and says, did you ever take drugs? You know. And my mom's sitting right there. She never, you know. And you have a choice of lying to the Dalai Lama or upsetting your mother, you know. And I said, yeah, I did. And she's like, you know. Then he says, what was it like? You know, and he was very interested. I think in those days, he, you know, many people were coming like that. Maybe he knew that was a good opener for a Westerner. But then he said, well, what was it like? And I said, well, it's kind of like meditation or something like that. I mean, in general, I think that maybe in some extraordinary cases, they have some benefit in making you aware that there are other realities. More specifically, all of those states of mind under the influence of a drug are not only wrong in the sense that we've been talking about, but they are, on top of that, they are mistaken in a relative sense, you know. In Buddhism, they don't count for almost anything, and they're not considered very useful at all. And it's just another example of a wrong perception, you know. It's like getting drunk and seeing something or like that, or being very angry and seeing something which is not true, being very jealous and thinking that people are out after you, you know, and it's just another wrong perception. In classical Buddhist scripture, not considered a very useful thing. Okay, I think in extraordinary cases, in a case where the person just can't accept that some other reality could exist, maybe some limited use. But when you think about it, if there is another mode of existence or some kind of paradise, why don't you just cause it to happen and get to it that way? And that will always be there. You can always sit there and enjoy it. You don't have to keep taking something, you know. Just generally preferable to cause it this way. Through ethical way of life and through compassion. Better to cause it that way. It'll last longer. You know. One more question. Yeah, Mr. Quinn. Oh, boy. he says, well, if I want to go back to my room right now and do a meditation entrance, what do you suggest I do? I mean, what am I supposed to do? What's an analytical meditation on emptiness? There's countless meditations on emptiness. And you know them from the scriptures. You know, there's like seven different analyses that you can do. Your ability to see the emptiness of an object decreases exponentially with the arrival of a mental affliction. Okay? Your ability to see the emptiness of an object decreases exponentially with the arising of a mental affliction. It means the madder you get, the more you grasp the self-existence of the person who's making you mad. Okay? That's just nature. That's why lamas say, go to a graveyard and meditate on emptiness. Go to a cliff and dangle your legs off the side and meditate on emptiness as you get scared out of your mind. Your perception of self will be most enhanced at the moment of greatest fear. And graveyards in Tibet or India, ancient India, were not these well-mowed with these, you know, they're actually kind of pleasant to stay in if you try it. But these, we're talking about carrion grounds. We're talking about places where you throw a body off of here, and by 1 hour after sunset, there's all these dangerous carnivoric animals wandering around there, slurping up somebody's arm, you know? And that's the point of grave. I mean, I guess it'd really be more like go to the zoo and go into a panther's cage and sit next to him and meditate on how strong your sense of a self asserts itself. And that was the real point. In general. But what I'm saying is, well, if it's a kind of dislike. Okay. But what I'm saying is that in the greatest heat of anger is when the false idea of a self, the belief in a self-existent self, asserts itself more strongly. The hardest place to meditate on emptiness is while someone's in your face screaming at you for the order that didn't get shipped out. You know, I can tell you. So what I'm saying is that what I suggest might be useful is go to the moment of your day at which your mental afflictions were most powerful. You know, go back to the moment in the last week, say, when your mental afflictions were at their most extreme. I believe for most people it would be anger. For some people it might be desire. For me, my specialty happens to be jealousy. When I hear that there's some American who's doing really good at translating and teaching, and I hear somebody praising them, I'm like, yeah. Okay. So pick your specialty. You know, go to your particular, the worst event of your week. And I would say, start to analyze the self-existence of that object. You know, what we said and what we keep saying is, the perception of the emptiness of that event, of the three spheres, and the anger cannot coexist at the same time. I would meditate on that. I would meditate on that. I would go back to the heaviest bad emotion I had had that week. And I would, in retrospect, right, you're supposed to be doing it at the moment, okay? It don't usually work. Go back 5 days, bring up that event again in your mind, and start to analyze the emptiness of the three spheres. Why is the boss empty? Why am I empty? Why is the event of him screaming at me empty? And what the hell use is all of that anyway? To think about the emptiness of it. What's that got to do with my life? I would say analyze the emptiness of the situation in that way. Okay. I would say start with that. How is understanding that this is a projection onto the parts of the yelling boss going to help me at all not to get angry next time? Because that analysis has two useful parts. You start to understand why what you did was wrong. You're probably taking a big shot at the bad karma you created. And then the next time it happens, I can tell you most likely when he yells at me on Thursday, I'll probably remember this course for the first few times, you know. And that's the whole point of a course, you know. So I would say meditate on that. It has those three benefits. You analyze why you blew it. That takes some energy out of the bad karma. And then next time you won't do it as quickly or as easily. So I would say if you're going to do an emptiness meditation, go to the event at which you had the strongest mental affliction, because that's the direct opposite of emptiness understanding. They cannot coexist. Okay. There must be the understanding of emptiness and the heavy mental affliction are totally opposite states of mind that cannot exist in the same skull at the same time. I would say meditate on that. Try to see why that's true. That has direct application to your life. It'll make you immediately start to be a happier person. Immediately. And then it'll knock the power out of your old bad karma. Okay, we'll stop there and I'll see you at 10 tomorrow. Okay. Next thing in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. Very cool. The Buddha comes out to the Buddha and says, "Oh, Lord Buddha, you know, you've been giving this teaching. What should we call it? You know, what name should we give the teaching you've been giving?" And if you're reading this sutra for the first time, you think he's going to say, "Diamond Cutter," you know. and he doesn't say that. He says, let's call it the Sharabgi Parotu Chimba. Say Sharabgi Parotu Chimba. Sharabgi Parotu Chimba. Okay, okay. In Sanskrit, Prajna Paramita. Okay, the perfection of wisdom. He says, let's call this book the perfection of wisdom. Right. And as you know, the other name of this book is the perfection of wisdom in 300 lines or something like that. Even though it's not cut up the way that, it's not cut up into verses, but they call it the perfection of wisdom. I believe you would say verses, although it's not verses, it's the equivalent of 300 verses of text. So they call it the 300. So sometimes it's called the perfection of wisdom in 300. The Buddha says, let's call it the perfection of wisdom. Then he goes on to say some other strange things. He says, and by the way, there is no perfection of wisdom. and then he says, and that's why we can call it the perfection of wisdom. Okay. Let's name the book Perfection of Wisdom. There ain't no perfection of wisdom, and that's why we can call it the perfection of wisdom. And that's the next scene in the sutra, okay? At this point, the Tibetan commentator, Chöni Lama Dapa Shidum, he goes through the different kinds of perfection wisdom. I think it's really important to know. So we're going to go through the, what does perfection wisdom mean? I mean, I used to wonder for a long time, you know, I never saw a really good explanation of what is the perfection of wisdom. You always hear Prajnaparamita Sutras, Prajnaparamita literature, blah, 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 and you don't know what's Prajnaparamita. So we're going to go through the four kinds of Prajnaparamita. The first thing to know is that it has a nickname, two nicknames. They take the she out of shera, out of she, and they take the ur out of rub, and they say sherchen, say sherchen, sherchen. So, I mean, nobody in the monastery goes around saying, Sherabdi, Paro, Dirchimba. They just say, how's your Sherchen going? You know, how's your study of Sherchen? Okay. In the monastery, well, I'm not going to go into it. Sherchen. Another name for it is not Isahyu. It's all like yummy. Say yum.
Yum.
Yum means mother. Okay, it's the honorific word for mother. When you're talking about the Dalai Lama's mother, you don't say ama. You say, how's your yum doing? You know, so yum means the great mother. Okay. This is referring to the perfection of wisdom. So the perfection of wisdom is also often called mother. And the sutras on the perfection of wisdom are often called the mother sutras. Why called mother? Because these are what give birth to Buddhas. Okay, the perfection of wisdom is what gives birth to Buddhas. Buddhas are the direct offspring of the perfection of wisdom. So the perfection of wisdom itself is often called yum, okay, the mother. Yeah. Yeah. He asked about all the different. There's a 300 Prajnaparamita. There's an 8,000. There's a 2,000, which is maybe really 2,500. Then there's a boom, which is 100,000. They say there's even longer ones that are missing nowadays. If you read them, they appear to be discrete teachings. They're not like they were distilled from each other. It looks like if you read the 8,000, it's really like a long science fiction story. Many different beings in them. So, it's not like they took the 100,000 and abbreviated it into 20. There seem to be different teachings on the perfection of wisdom. So why is the perfection of wisdom, and for example, in the Heart Sutra, It's the feminine ending on the end of the Bhagavati. It's the Chomden De Ma. They call it the mother. It's always feminine because it's producing Buddhas. It's child-bearing Buddhas, bearing Buddha children. Okay, and that's why it's called the mother. And that refers to the perfection of wisdom as a Paro Tu Chin Che. Nice, cool. Paro Tu Chin Che, we talked about it. Perfection as something that gets you to perfection. Perfection as something that creates perfection. The real meaning of perfection, like the perfection of giving, is the thing that gets you to the perfection of giving. And obviously that's like generating Buddhahood, generating perfection. So the idea is that this is the real mommy of all enlightened states, is Prajnaparamita. Okay. What are the four kinds? Say Rangshin, Sherchen, Rangshin, Sherchen. Rangshin means natural. Natural. Sherchen means perfection of wisdom. The natural perfection of wisdom. This is the same thing as what they call natural nirvana, Rangshin Nyangde. And it refers to emptiness itself. Okay, emptiness itself, emptiness itself, is given the nickname natural perfection of wisdom. Natural nirvana, same thing. Does it mean somehow that you've already reached nirvana or something like that? No, not at all. We wish, right? It'd be a lot easier. It just means that this is the object which the perfection of wisdom focuses on, emptiness. So it's called the natural perfection of wisdom. Rangshin Shechen. Say Shung Shechen. Shung Shechen. Shung means scriptural. Okay? Scriptural. Perfection of wisdom as a book or as a teaching, as a verbal teaching or as a book, is called Shung Shechen. And for example, the Prajnaparamita Sutras are that. The sutras which mainly treat the perfection of wisdom. The sutras which mainly talk about the perfection of wisdom are themselves called the perfection of wisdom. So when somebody says Prajnaparamita Sutras, you've got to be thinking Shung Shechen, the book, or the oral teachings about the perfection of wisdom. The second kind of the perfection of wisdom. Say Lam Shechen. Lam Shechen. Lam means, you know, path. This is the perfection of wisdom, which is the path. Okay? The perfection of wisdom, which is the path. This is the real one. Okay? If you want to say, which is the real one, this is the real one. Alright? This is the real Paro Tichin Che. Okay? This is the thing that gets you to that paradise that we talked about. This is the thing that makes the glass of liquid or water turn into a glass of bliss. Okay? That's the path, Prajnaparamita. And its definition is very cool, so you should learn it. Taekchen? Say Taekchen? Semkeki? Simbe? Tongyi? Tokpe? Yeshe? One more time. Just because it's a blessing, and all those people said they'd never learn Tibetan, always end up being the teachers, actually. Taekchen? Semkeki? Simbe? Tongyi? Tokpe? Yeshe? Definition of the perfection of wisdom. This is the path, perfection of wisdom. Taekchen Semke means bodhicitta. Taekchen Semke means the wish to become enlightened so that you can help other beings, so that you can take them after you. Okay? Taekchen Semke. Taekchen Semke is Simba. The Simba means soaked in. Alright? Soaked in. Imbued with. Alright? And we'll talk about that. Tongyi means what? Shunyata, okay? Shunyata, emptiness. Dongyi means emptiness. Dongyi Tokpe Yeshe means that state of knowledge where you perceive emptiness, okay? Where you perceive emptiness, where you realize emptiness. So the definition of the perfection of wisdom is the wisdom which understands emptiness or which perceives emptiness, okay? And which is also totally soaked in the wish to achieve enlightenment for other sentient beings. Okay? Oh, for yourself too, by the way. So basically two parts. You have to have ultimate compassion. You have to have bodhicitta. And you have to have the perception of emptiness. Did it say, Did it say direct perception of emptiness? No. Okay? It doesn't say direct. So it means you don't have to achieve the path of seeing, the third path, to have the perfection of wisdom. It does not say direct perception. Okay? It could be direct perception, but it doesn't say only direct perception. So it could be all those other perceptions. You are right now having a Tujungi Sherab about emptiness. During this week, unless you've been asleep totally, which is always possible, you've been having an intellectual understanding of emptiness. That is Tongyi Tokpe Yeshe. You are understanding, you are perceiving emptiness at a certain level. As long as you're thinking about it in a roughly correct way, intellectually even, even before you reach the first path, you are perceiving emptiness in a way. Okay? You are understanding it in a very rough, intellectual way. That is Doni Tokushiram. If it's Semgegi Simba, if you also have some kind of compassion on it, or wish to help other people, then you have the perfection of wisdom. Okay? Then you are practicing the perfection of wisdom. And that's the real one. That's the one that's really getting you there. The homework key is goofy, okay? It says number 4. probably some text in that song. Say Debu Shechin. Debu Shechin. Debu means in this case it means the final goal. Normally it means result. Okay, but here it means the final goal. The perfection of wisdom of the final goal. What is the highest form of wisdom? Not Buddhahood. Not emptiness. We're talking wisdom, which is mental. Half of the Dhammakaya, which is the omniscience of the Buddha. Yeah, Jnana Dhammakaya. The omniscience of the Buddha. The Buddha's ability to know all things. The Buddha's knowing all things. The wisdom of the Buddha, which perceives all objects in the universe at once, is the perfection of wisdom of the final goal. That's the fourth kind of the perfection of wisdom. So now you're experts about perfection of wisdom. Okay? If anybody says, what's the perfection of wisdom? You can say, well, which one are you talking about? You know, are you talking about the natural one? That's emptiness. Are you talking about the books? That's shun, scriptural perfection of wisdom. Are you talking about perfection of wisdom on the path? That's the perception of emptiness imbued with bodhicitta. Or are you talking about the final perfection of wisdom, which is the one in the mind of a Buddha? Which one is this book? I mean, this is you do this in a monastery and you have a 4-hour debate on your hands. is the Diamond Cutter Sutra the natural perfection of wisdom? I mean, when the Buddha says, you can call this book the perfection of wisdom, is he referring to the natural perfection of wisdom? Good question. I mean the sutra. Well, let's go through all four. Is it emptiness? No. Emptiness is a negative thing. It's an absence of something. Okay. It's like the lack of elephants on this platform. Okay. It's just an absence of something. Well, normal size, unless they're hiding behind the stupa. So this is not like the lack of something, you know, like the lack of money in our pockets. That's a negative, unchanging, meaning its quality doesn't change. If you get money, it goes out of existence. But while it's with you, which it often is, it doesn't change. And that's a total lack of something. It's either there or it's not. If it's not there, that's its emptiness. And so the book is not it can't be the first perfection of wisdom. So the Buddha definitely didn't mean that. How about number 2? Okay, sure. It is the expression of that subject matter. You know, it does talk about the perfection of wisdom. Is it number 3? Is the book, which if you want to say in the Abhidhamma, they ask that question and they say Suttam Da. You know, what are words? And at the lowest level, they are sounds and shapes. At a little bit higher level, they are conceptualization. But is this sutra the third perfection of wisdom? I just said the sutra. No, you have to say no. It's either sounds or shapes of letters or some kind of conceptualizations as you hear the words, but it's not the meaning of the sutra or the point of the sutra or what the sutra is teaching. That's something else. So Diamond Cutter Sutra is not the path itself. The path itself is that perception of emptiness under the influence of bodhicitta. Okay. So the book is not perfection number 3. The subject matter of the book is number 3. And maybe the other ones also. But mainly number 3. And is this number 4? No, it's not the mind of a Buddha. Okay, minds are invisible to normal people. Minds don't have color. Minds don't have shapes. Okay, you can think of colors and shapes in your mind, but that's a different thing. Okay, so that's what the Buddha is talking about This is the perfection of wisdom, meaning this is Shung Xiexin. This is the expression of the expression of wisdom, of the perfection of wisdom. And its subject matter is primarily the third, the path. The perfection of wisdom as the path, primarily. Primarily is a wonderful word in debating that gets you out of all kinds of problems. If somebody comes up and says, well, it does really teach the Buddha's omniscience also, you can say, oh, I said primarily. All right.
Okay. The Janus Dharmakaya, can you say it's the mind of the Buddha? I'm hearing two things.
Yeah.
The mind
They are yin kyap yam. They are totally the same thing. The mind of a Buddha and the omniscience of a Buddha are totally equal. Same thing. There's no mind of the Buddha which is not omniscient. There's no omniscience of the Buddha which is not mind. Okay. Then the Buddha says, what's he saying next about the perfection of wisdom? Now, what did I say he said after that? The Buddha says, what do we call this book? What do we call this teaching? He says perfection wisdom. And then he says, by the way, there ain't no perfection wisdom. And that's why we can call it the perfection wisdom. Chöni Dapa Shedrup jumps on this. He loves it. He says, oh, finally he got to one of the most important points. And that's Uma, okay? Not the movie star. Say Uma. Uma. In Sanskrit, what's it called? Madhyamika. Okay? Madhyamika. In English, the middle way. And in fact, the word the mid in middle and the med in medium all come from the Sanskrit mad, med, same root actually. The mad and madhyamika and the mid and middle, ultimately they all come from the same thing. Okay? You've been studying Madhyamika. Okay? We've been studying Madhyamika. As a school of ancient India, which is not the way I'm talking about it today, but just so you know, it had two parts, lower Madhyamika, higher Madhyamika. We'll talk about it later. Everything we've been talking about is higher Madhyamika. Higher Madhyamika school is the school of Nagarjuna, is the school of Tsongkhapa, is the school of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Sopa, Lama Yeshe, and is the school of Shakyamuni Buddha, alright? It's the highest school. Well, didn't the Buddha teach the other school? Yes. Are they, strictly speaking, accurate? No. In some cases, okay? Are they therefore useless and we should forget them? No. They fit different students of different capacities. If they're not ready to hear the highest interpretation, give them something lower. If you ever try to teach Buddhism to your kids, you'll understand why the Buddha taught the other three schools. You can't go into Madhyamika Prasangika philosophy with your kids. You have to say, don't kill a bird because it's not nice. You know, that's not the ultimate reason why not to kill a bird. But that's where you have to start. And that's how the four schools started. They are very wonderful. They are very necessary. They are brilliant. They are taught by an omniscient being. They are designed to fit the minds of every possible disciple that might come along. And you must learn them all, because they address the doubts that come up in any student's mind. Okay. What's that? Yeah, you can call it consequences. Prasangika means like consequence. Excuse me? Say again. Maybe. I haven't heard of them spoken of that way. But it makes sense. People talk about emptiness. But I haven't heard it called that. Okay. So that's not the Uma I'm talking about, okay? I'm not going to talk about the school called Madhyamika. I'm talking about the state of mind called Madhyamika. What is Madhyamika? What is Uma? What is the middle way? What does the word middle suggest to you? Yeah, going between two extremes, okay? And those extremes are not extreme in the sense of a political party or something like that. They are, in the word in Tibetan and the word in Sanskrit, refers to extreme in the sense of walking off this platform. Okay? The edge. The edge of a cliff. Okay? You have to think that way. Ta, or extreme, in this case means the edge of a cliff. Alright? And you can think of a pathway. I'm not a good artist and people in New York know that. Here's the path to the city of enlightenment, okay? And on each side are these horrible chasms, these horrible, deep, yawning chasms, you know? And you can either fall off this way, or you can fall off the other side, okay? And that's what Uma means. Uma means you have to thread a very fine line between two cliffs, Kami's cliff. And if you're not careful, like I've been trying to be very mindful of when, especially over there, not to fall off the back of the thing, you know. You have to keep your wits about you, or you will fall off one of these cliffs. Either case is disaster. Either case is a fatal error. You will waste your life. You will never get what you need. You will never understand anything. And you will continue to suffer. You will die, and you will continue to suffer after that. So this is a very important subject. You know, these are the two cliffs. And if spiritually you fall in off of either cliff, it's over with. Okay? Unless you can climb back up, unless you grab onto some little branch on the way down, you know, and get back up, which is hard, your spiritual body will die. So extremely bad consequences. I mean, spiritual death, essentially. So you have to know these two extremes. You must know what the two cliffs are. And to thread your way between them is what? Madhyamika. That's the meaning of Uma. But it's not just like a centrist position between communism and fascism or something like that. You know, it's not like that. These are deadly, fatal errors. If you fall into either one, spiritually your life is over. Okay. It doesn't mean you can't recover if you get some good teachings, but if your state of mind falls into either extreme, you're in big trouble. Extremely big trouble. Okay. Dead, fatal error. Okay. So Uma becomes important. You know, Uma becomes a very essential, life-saving thing. And think of it as life-saving. To lose your life is not so bad. To go off the edge of a Buddhist extreme is 10 times worse, much worse. It's a much worse death after that, okay? What are the two extremes? Say yata?
Yeah.
Yata? Yeah. Ta means edge, okay? Ta means that edge of the cliff. Ta means the edge of the cliff. Okay. Yu means existence. Things exist. Okay. And I'll say it in plain English. The fact that things exist the way I always thought they did. The fact that things exist the way I always thought they did. And now I have a tricky question for you. Does that exist? Does the fact that things exist the way you thought they did, or I'll say it a different way, does the existence of all these things the way you used to think it existed even exist? No, it's another gotcha. It's another gotcha. If I say, is it true that things exist the way you thought they did, you say, no. That means they don't exist. I mean, things which could exist the way you always thought they existed is something which could never exist.
So yata doesn't exist.
So yata does not exist. It's very interesting. Yata does not exist. So how can you fall off yata? How can you fall into yata? Okay. Say tanzin. I better put it up here. Tanzin means grasping onto the yata, believing in it. Okay. Believing that everything existed the way you always thought it did. It's called tanzin. Does that exist? Oh yeah, that's the source of all problems. It's not money. It's tanzin. Probably they're related somewhere, I guess. But that's tanzin. Okay, so. thinking that it's true that everything was the way you thought it was is the problem. Okay. And this ta is the one that's most dangerous.
Okay.
This is the ta that infects 99.999% of all humanity. If you go up to somebody in Boulder Creek, you know, at Joe's Bar, wherever that was, and you say, does this beer exist the way you always thought it did? Or is this a projection of yours generated by your past karmic seeds upon an empty screen? And he'll look at you like, you know, like, are you crazy? Maybe you should have a beer, you know. The mass of humanity streams like lemmings off the cliff, you know. They are like sheep in a huge, what do you call it, walking off this cliff, you know. They don't see that anything is in any way different from the way they think it is, or that the way they always thought it was. What does it mean in real life, okay? How does it relate to real life? How could you do a reality check and see, do I have Yuta and Zimba in my mind at any given moment, okay? How are you going to do a check on yourself to see, do I have Yuta today? Am I grasping onto Yuta today or not? Great, he said if you're upset. John said if you're upset, okay? And the point is, use the moment when you are most angry, you know. In Tibet, they said use the moment when you are most afraid. You know, go sit up on a skyscraper and dangle your legs off the side and watch your feeling about yourself. Pabongka Rinpoche says, wait till somebody accuses you of doing something that you never even thought of doing, you know, and you get in big trouble from this person accusing you of something that you have no intention of doing and no even dream of doing. But they are accusing you of it, other people are believing it, and then suddenly you got this thing in your heart like, how can they be saying that about me? You know, me. And then that me, when you're under the influence of a strong mental affliction, is definitely your time. Because if I came up to you and said, is this happening external to you without your projections? Is this you or this guy who's attacking you? I find it easier with the guy who's attacking me. Is this guy who's attacking you? And this is very difficult to do because at that moment, it's the last thing you want to think about. You truly, really think that this guy is evil from his own side. You really, truly think that this person is bad inherently from their side. You just can't believe that there could be any other possibility. They're attacking you. They're attacking something very dear to you, and hatred comes up. And you, at that moment, it's almost absolutely impossible to think that what I'm seeing is not coming from him. Mm-hmm. What I'm going through right now is in no way coming from him or her. It's just not. This is me. Do I mean it in the sense of psychological projection? No. You know? Shoe salesmen get on a bus. All they see is shoes. You know? Diamond buyers get on a bus. All they're doing is looking at women's fingers, you know? I don't mean like that. I don't mean that your mind is sort of into that and you're noticing that more or less. I don't mean like that. I mean, I don't mean to say, because you had a bad breakfast, this guy looks evil to you. I don't mean that. He really is evil. Okay? And we're going to get into that. He really is evil at that moment. But not from his side. Okay? It's not coming from him. If you had not collected the karma to meet this evil person, who really is evil, you would not be meeting an evil person now. There wouldn't be an evil person there accusing you of this thing if you had not collected bad karma yourself. Okay? It doesn't exist. How does the bad karma make him evil? It causes you to glue together the sense data in a certain way called evil guy and call it evil. You give it the name evil. You think of it as evil. It doesn't have to be thought of as evil. Nothing in the world has any inherent quality of its own, period. Nothing in the world has any inherent quality of its own, period. I always talk about the dentist, okay? Like, the feel of a dentist drill on your tooth must be evil. You know, when they hit the nerve, you know, I mean, the whole thing of going to the dentist, you know, the whole thing of having to sit there and pay to have somebody torment you, you know, I mean, that must be something inherently distasteful. That thing of the drill hitting the nerve must be something inherently unpleasant. But if you've ever been to India, and you're a Westerner, and you go to Connaught Circle, which I've done, and you go to the dentist because your teeth is hurting like crazy, and he sees a Westerner walk in, and he has the opportunity to drill up a Westerner's tooth, and he sees rupee, 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 you know, that same event is a pleasant event. Okay. It's a pleasant event. Someone is sitting around a glass of liquid and seeing it as nectar. You know, he sees your cavity as big bucks. You know, and for him, the same sense data is when you jump, he's thinking, great. You know, maybe he needs a root canal. You know, and it's the same data. He is synthesizing it because of his past karma. As a pleasant event, and it is a result of good karma for him. If a Westerner walks in with these big money belts they wear, and he needs a root canal, it's like it is a result of his good karma. Now, is it a good karma that he's thinking to cheat you or something? Obviously not. But the fact that you showed up in his office is good karma. So at one moment, the same sense data. What I'm trying to say is there's nothing you can point to in the world which is inherently one way or the other. And that's its emptiness. Okay? Yata is to be blissfully ignorant of that thing. And why does it cause you trouble? Why does it kill your spiritual life if you hold to that? Well, if you really believe that the people in your life who attack you are inherently evil, and that it's not coming from your side, and that it's not coming from your karma that you collected and that you're responsible for it, then you will retaliate. The moment you retaliate, you are assuring that you'll meet him again and someone will attack you again. Last thing to say about that, does that mean you have to sit and be wimpy when someone accuses you of something you haven't done? No. Bodhisattva vow. You have to defend yourself, especially if they're saying something dirty about you. You have to try to explain yourself. You must. But you cannot see the event as self-existent. As you explain yourself and as you defend yourself, you have to see the whole situation as being empty of any self-existence, which means you will never get mad at the guy. You will never hate the person, because that's only going to bring them back. You say, I can't hate this person, I have to defend myself. Does the defending always work? No, and that you better be ready for that too. Because what happens after you defend yourself is also up to your own projection. And what kind of karma you collected in the past. What kind of behavior does this lead to? And then I'll answer some questions, okay? What kind of behavior will this lead to? Your life will continue to be as screwy as it was before, okay? Don't expect anything different. In the immediate, eventually it'll change. But not until you do those four forces and clean out your karmic pocket. But what's the effect on your mind? Totally, without any kind of bad feelings ever. And that's nirvana. Okay. And you can do it. Don't wait for the world around you to straighten out. It ain't going to. You know? It just won't happen. In the chaos of life, as your crazy random karmic bad seeds express themselves in your life, you have to straighten out your own mental afflictions by not reacting with hatred or desire. Okay. And that's nirvana. If you keep that up, if you keep up not reacting for a while, you can reach nirvana. If you keep up that over a long period of time and you do your purifications, then you reach paradise, Buddha paradise. That's the difference between level 8 and level 10. Okay? Cool. How do you get to level 8?
Level 1.
Understand the emptiness of the guy who's accusing you. Okay. It's very cool. This is the path to nirvana. This is the path to Buddhahood. There ain't no more to say, really. I mean, we'll have another class, okay? But you got all the data now. You have all the information. Now you have to implement it. That ain't so easy.
Okay, yeah.
No thing is inherently evil, but are there any acts that are inherently evil, like the act of stealing?
No. Is an act of stealing inherently evil? We talked about it yesterday. At a certain level, after millions of years of practice as a bodhisattva, you are required by your bodhisattva vow to steal if it would be of great benefit to another being. Monks are required by their bodhisattva vows to work if it would be of benefit to other beings. So, stealing too. Okay. Now, what about wrong view? What about time in? Could that ever be a good thing? That isn't what I meant to say. I didn't mean to say it could have been good or could have been bad. In the case of time in, the point is that it could have been wisdom if you had collected different karmic seeds. The same mental event could have been interpreted by your mind.